listen to my daddy and my Uncle Drew. Not in the creepy way.
You're a bad person.
It's perfect. It's possible.
Awkward. I did not see that coming.
Oh, come on.
That's okay. I like this podcast.
Welcome. I'm Eric.
I'm Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1984 movie Beverly Hills Cop, directed by Martin Brest, who I didn't recognize his name, but turns out he's directed a lot of really good movies.
Oh, do tell. I'm not familiar with his name either.
He directed Midnight Run, and I don't have the whole list in front of me. Midnight Run, and then a couple other really good movies, but then he directed Geely.
Have you seen that?
I only saw like the first half.
Was it really that bad? I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, I don't think it was, you know, like super bad. Although I think it has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 0.
At some point, that's just sport.
Probably. I don't think people understand what Rotten Tomatoes is. I think there are people that think that some guys who call themselves Rotten Tomatoes review films. It's like people will suggest that Rotten Tomatoes gives something a thumbs up. It's like, no, they really don't. They just give you a number.
Oh, that was my other bit of housekeeping, actually.
Okay.
If we may. Or do you want me to save it for the end?
No, we may. Absolutely.
Did you get a chance to look at the trailer for the Roger Ebert documentary?
I did not.
It was pretty good. That's really, really interesting.
He was an interesting guy. I mean, I definitely want to watch it because he got a lot of crap for, writing Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, for being a film critic that ended up, pretty much being responsible for one of a really bad movie. But
there's actually a really funny blurb in the trailer where someone is talking about how Roger Ebert wrote Valley of the Dolls, but Gene Siskel lived it. Apparently, Siskel enjoyed the nightlife in the disco era.
Oh, yeah. Siskel owned John Travolta's suit from Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah, that was his favorite movie.
Anyway, so, I'm highly interested in that. Have you seen the movie... the documentary about the Indonesian warlord guys?
No.
Do you know anything about it?
No.
Well, I don't, of course, know the name of the movie, so I'll probably take this all out, but it's basically a documentary about these, like, military leaders or, like, revolutionary leaders in Indonesia who ended up committing all of these crimes against humanity, and they went and interviewed these guys who are still alive. And I guess these guys had a lot of like the gangster culture. Like they thought they were gangsters. You know, they fashioned themselves a Godfather or a Tony Montana kind of figure. And then they had these actual guys do actual recreations of the atrocities, including like killing a baby. And they're having entirely too much fun. And I have not seen the movie. I've only seen the trailer for it, and I've heard some stuff about it. But it just sounds horrifying and completely intriguing.
Is it called, like, Acts of War or something like that?
Yes.
Okay. I have heard of it then.
Yeah. So I'm eager to see it, but, it'll come. It's not available on Netflix yet, so... And I didn't want to buy it for $25, so that's where I draw the line.
Seems like a reasonable line.
Well, and especially since I am unlikely to rewatch a movie that talks about war crimes and interviews the people that perpetrated them. Doesn't seem like a lot of review value.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be fascinating to watch once.
Yeah, exactly. Unlike, say, Swimming to Cambodia. Could we even tackle a movie like Swimming to Cambodia?
I have no idea. I've never seen it.
You've never seen Swimming to Cambodia? Oh, my
no.
God.
The Spalding Gray movie?
Yeah.
I haven't seen any Spalding Gray movies.
Oh, well, okay. This is right for a tangent, because when I watched Swimming to Cambodia the first time, I immediately... It was a VHS copy, and I immediately made an audio cassette of the movie so I could listen to the movie over and over and over like an audiobook. And that and Monster in a Box, I think I still have the cassettes of those. Fantastic. I mean, because it's basically a monologue. There's very little visual things in either movie. He basically sits down at a desk and he tells you the story. And both stories are great. The Swimming to Cambodia, he talks about how he had a very small part in the Killing Fields movie. But of course, because he's a storyteller, he weaves all these other things into the telling of the story, including teaching you a lot about the Vietnam War and then the Cambodian Revolution and how America's sort of the bad guy in all of those stories. Although that wasn't really the focus. It was more the focus of here are these people that, you know, basically they thought they could count on us and then we deserted them and then all these bad things happened. But he's such a good storyteller that he has you the whole way through. Fantastic. I mean, I probably listened to it 100 times and I've seen the movie 3 or 4. So I highly recommend them. I will somehow get them to you because you need to at some point see them because he's just a masterful storyteller.
You already got them to me.
Oh, did I? Okay. Oh, there I did. There you go. Yeah, I highly recommend them. I mean,
I think there were 4 of them, right?
3 I know. I mean, there's Swimming in Cambodia. There is Monster in a Box, which is the story of him taking Swimming to Cambodia to Russia, and also him trying to write a novel that he just can't seem to write. That's the monster, by the way. And then there's Grey's Anatomy, where he had a problem with his eye, and since he was raised as a Christian Scientist, he wasn't really keen on doctors. So he went to a lot of alternative medicine things before he got to an actual surgeon or whatever was needed. But he weaves these personal stories into, like, he talks about his life as well as all the subject matter he's talking about. So you get a continuing story of his life. And then there's, if I included it, there's the last movie where it actually is about his death because he committed suicide. And
do you know what that one's called?
I don't remember. There was another book or movie. Well, I know it was a book in between there where it talks about skiing. That's the Slippery Slope, maybe. And there his personal life gets very, very messy. And so he is not the hero in the story at all because his girlfriend character that he never was going to marry, he always found reasons not to marry her. He ends up having a baby with somebody else. So you don't like him very much for part of that. Yeah, Spalding Gray was the real deal. I can't imagine I didn't infect you with Spalding Gray because he was like top of my list.
There were some things that I was ridiculously stubborn about when I was little, just trying to form my own identity. Things like deciding I hated the Beatles because Jason liked them.
Well, I guess that's natural, though. I mean, you know.
Yeah, she's so dumb, though.
Yeah, but kids are dumb. That's what you're there for.
Yeah, so I put Herb Chamberlain and Spalding Gray sort of in the same box. I had no reason not to like them, but I remember you liked them so much that I decided I didn't like them just so I could be different.
Huh. Well, I'm sure there's many things.
Unlike the Beatles, I never went back and revisited them.
Well, you know, now I'm obviously a little bit less passionate about it just because now there are other things like this. I mean, he was doing something that I had never seen before. That's why I really liked the Henry Rollins stories because they were just like Spalding Gray stories. I mean, I thought, well, Henry Rollins is a damn good storyteller.
You got into Henry Rollins, the spoken word stuff when I was a little bit older, so I was a little bit more open-minded. So, I did enjoy those.
And they were more funny, too. I mean, those stories were gritty and funny and, you know, Spalding Gray is just, you know, he's a different persona. I mean, his, you know, Henry Rollins is like the tough rock guy with the gravelly voice. And Spalding Gray was the New Englander with the thin, like a kind of aristocratic, almost effeminate voice. Although, did you at all get into, oh, I bet you didn't. I bet you hated it on purpose. Stephen Jesse Bernstein?
No, I never had any opinion.
I must have inflicted that on Jason, because I remember putting the cassette in the car and having people in the backseat groan about how, oh no, not this again. Because for about 5 minutes, every opportunity to play that Stephen Jesse Bernstein album, I did.
Yeah, I still have no idea who that is.
I'll have to find it and get you a copy because it's great. He's a poet. He killed himself too. I think with a pair of scissors or something. But he was this, he has a horrible, horrible voice, and he was mentally ill for sure. And he did this like long, like spoken word poems that I think the Sub Pop guys went and put music in the background of, maybe after his death, but maybe just before his death.
So like American Prayer style?
Kinda. Yeah, you'll have to listen. It's interesting. Oh, yeah, that's another thing. That whole Jim Morrison thing. Turns out Jim Morrison wasn't a great poet, but he had a lot of fun ideas for what turns out to be a young guy. Anyway.
Yeah, well, did a lot of drugs.
Oh, yeah, and he was, you know, he was going to college and listened to all, you know, prime time for philosophy conversations and yeah, LSD and stuff was big. Yeah, I mean, it's perfectly understandable. Okay, so back to Beverly Hills Cop, 1984. Let's start out with the soundtrack, if you don't mind.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Do you remember the two of us seeing this movie in the theater together?
I do not.
Pretty sure I saw it in the theater, and I can't imagine anybody else would have been as irresponsible enough to take an 8-year-old than you.
Well, yeah, it would have had, but I wouldn't have been all that old. Somebody would have had to drop us off because I wouldn't have been driving us to the theater.
But I'm certain I saw it in the theater because I remember being really excited a few years later to go see Beverly Hills Cop 2 in the theater, which I was, I think, 11 when that came out. So I have a little bit more memory of that. Rewatching this movie, this is another one of those movies that is not appropriate for me to have seen when I was as young as I did.
Meh, I suppose. We'll get to it when we get to it, but...
Yes, we will.
Yeah, okay. Oh, this will be fun, because you have some definite opinions about this movie. Can we start with the soundtrack, or should we...
We can start with the soundtrack.
Because, to me, the soundtrack speaks a lot of the time of the movie, and also, I mean, because it's the songs that were popular around it and because of it, but it also speaks to the fact that there are some legitimate hits in here, and I don't think you would have a soundtrack these days with as many hits in it.
Yeah, nowadays they try and manufacture one big hit, usually put over the end credits. But this one started out with a very familiar song right off the bat. And even parts of the score, you know, Axel Foley's theme song itself, have paved the way for synth music to become popular as its own genre.
Oh, absolutely. The Axel F theme? Fantastic. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm over the end credits of this particular podcast. There might be a surprise. But not all surprises are good, but there'll be something fun. Anyway, yeah, so the track listings of the soundtrack are Patti LaBelle's New Attitude, which is a fantastic song. There's a couple of crap things in here. Then there's The Neutron Dance by the Pointer Sisters. There's The Heat Is On by Glenn Frey. There's, Patti LaBelle's Stir It Up. I mean, it's fantastic. And then, yeah, the Axel theme is just... it's great. It's fantastic. But it definitely spoke to the time in filmmaking, too, because in a lot of the transition scenes are where you hear these songs.
Right. And not really in a, not in a montage kind of like Rocky fashion. but more as you mentioned, just the scene transition.
Or even during the action scenes.
Really, it's only the first action scenes that I think of for that, right?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
The first big set piece that introduces Axel as a character.
Well, what we have is a cigarette smuggling operation, and we've got Axel Foley, Eddie Murphy, basically trying to sell these cigarettes to these folks, and he needs to get $5,000 for them. And the thing about Axel Foley is that he's very glib, as Tom Cruise would say. Everything that makes the movie work, as far as I'm concerned, is all Eddie Murphy. That's not quite true. Everything that works about the Axel Foley character is because it plays to all of Eddie Murphy's strengths.
No, I think that's absolutely accurate. This movie reminded me of what a force of nature Eddie Murphy was in the early and mid-80s. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head how old he was when he made Beverly Hills Cop, but he looked really young. But he commanded the movie. And I think this movie was written for someone else. Someone like a more standard acting star.
Oh, I can get it. I know exactly who it was written for and that development if you want to get into it.
Was it Schwarzenegger?
Nope. Axel Foley was originally offered to Mickey Rourke, who they paid him $400,000 to star in the film, like a retainer. But the production was delayed so long for whatever reason that after that retaining contract expired, he just left for other work. He had other stuff to do. And I'm sure he kept the $400,000. So then they offered it to Sylvester Stallone. And the Michael character is Stallone's brother, and the Jenny character is the love interest. So it would have been, in fact, Stallone took what his characterization of this character was the character he ended up playing in Cobra.
That makes complete sense when you're watching the movie with some distance, you know, that we now have the luxury of doing so, because there are so many instances where you can feel a movie that's not as high a quality would go in one direction. But I think primarily due to the force of Eddie Murphy's talent and his charisma, it goes in a completely different direction. You know, like, not necessarily needing a love interest. There wasn't a lot of, physicality to Axel Foley. He got by mostly with his wits. He was tough, but he didn't have to be a tough guy. And, it made the movie really unique, I think, especially for that period of time. And well, it's really apparent watching it now, you know, with some perspective.
Well, his character, what I liked about the character was, you know, he was funny. I mean, obviously, you know, he got by with his wits. He was hilarious and can drop the jokes like crazy and the quick impressions that were funny. But his character, even though he was usually the most savvy guy in the room from the police standpoint, he also was sort of cowed. I mean, he knew that he had superiors and he had been disappointing them. And his, you know, he was several times, like when the first scene where he goes into and meets the lieutenant at the Beverly Hills cop station, you know, he is like in full, I'm being disciplined mode. You know, I'm just going to try to lay low and get through this meeting and get out the door. You know, he's not really boisterous or anything. He knows that this is his place, and he's being dressed down by his superiors because he's actually a cop.
Yeah, he's not brash. He's just witty.
Yeah, and he's not necessarily... I mean, I guess he's a rule breaker, but not just for the sake of breaking rules.
Right.
And you like him right from the beginning.
Yeah, great. He has an amazing amount of charisma, which as a movie star, I think he has lost along the way. I can't remember the last Eddie Murphy vehicle that I really enjoyed.
I can.
Is it Beverly Hills Cop?
Nope. It's Bowfinger. Yeah, I don't know how you feel about that movie, but I love the movie Bowfinger.
It's good, but he's not really...
He's not the star of it.
No, he shares it.
Yeah.
He shares the movie.
I think Coming to America, though, was pretty great.
Yes, it was. I also have a special place in my heart for Golden Child.
I don't think I've ever seen the whole thing of Golden Child.
It's pretty bonkers.
But, you know, sometimes bonkers is what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we meet Axel Foley, and he's in Detroit. That's where he's a police officer. And he's basically doing this unauthorized cigarette smuggling operation. And he is then, this is interrupted by two uniformed officers that roll up on this semi that he's selling the cigarettes out of. And he's trying to play it off, but it doesn't work. And they, the bad guys end up, it spooks the bad guys. So they end up running. So Eddie Murphy's in the back of this semi, like dangling quite precariously, actually, at times, from this chain on the side. I guess it's what they used to close the door with. As this semi is being chased by, 50 police cars. And I don't know about you, but this actually may even be accurate for 1984 Detroit. I don't know. But it seemed like, they just got a whole bunch of Chrysler K cars and they put the magnetic stickers on them that said Detroit Police on the side of it.
They looked pretty hokey.
Yeah, yeah.
But it may be an accurate representation.
Well, that's the thing, is you don't know. I mean, now it seems like that would be overdoing it.
Indeed.
But it was fun, you know? And the whole point was that he creates all this havoc with all these smashed police cars and other things that are smashed, and it's all an unauthorized thing anyway. So his boss is really angry with him. That's Inspector Douglas Todd. And it's played by Gil Hill. Do you know what Gil Hill was in before?
I've never seen him before.
He was a Detroit police officer, and then became eventually a Detroit city councilman. He was an actual cop. He was quoted as saying that the only difference between his character in the movie and him in real life is that he swore a lot more in the movie.
That's funny. He did a good job.
Oh yeah, I thought he did a great job. And the smaller parts in this, I had forgotten. I mean, I remember the whole Eddie Murphy la 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 la. I don't even remember it as being I cannot hear Jeffrey. But Jeffrey, who is another detective, I guess, or cop of some kind in Detroit, is played by
Paul Reiser.
Yes,
very young looking Paul Reiser.
Absolutely. You know, I'm going to start a list that I'm going to call the list of goddamn national treasure actors, and Paul Reiser is going to be on that list.
Don't get all crazy now.
I don't know. What have you seen Paul Reiser in that you didn't like?
Life.
Okay.
He was fine. Mad About You, but yeah, ever seeing him in interviews.
Oh no, is he a bad guy?
He's not a bad guy. He's just.
Is he Kevin Spacey?
No, he's not like a giant douchebag.
Oh, okay. Because Kevin Spacey is a douchebag.
I'm aware of, but I'm not sure how to describe it. Sort of like how you get tired of just watching Robin Williams. Like he gets old.
Yeah, okay.
So he's just doing the Paul Reiser thing all the time.
Fair enough. I mean, I'll give you that. But I was happy to see him in this movie, however briefly.
Pretty sure he's in the sequel, too, with a bigger role.
Yeah, pretty sure. Was it 3 with Joe Pesci? Oh, no, that's Lethal Weapon. I'm even getting my series mixed up. That's embarrassing. Basically, after this whole thing, Axel meets up with his old friend, who is Mickey Tandino. And Mickey and Axel have been friends for a long time. I'm sorry?
Mikey.
I'm sorry. He meets up with his old friend, Mikey Tandino. And by the way, he's played by James Russo, who has been in pretty much every mob movie, I think.
The scene when Axel comes home to find his apartment door open is hilarious because Eddie Murphy does the goofiest looking cop maneuvers, you know, when he's clearing the room.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
They definitely did not send him like to a police academy to learn how to look like a real cop.
Oh, no. Yeah, he's putting his arm with his gun in the room before he actually looks into the room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I think is awesome too.
And then almost coming to like a jump stop when he turns the corner.
But again, this is not about realism. It's not a gritty police procedural. This is a goofy movie where he meets up with his friend Mikey.
And yeah, you say that, but it gets pretty gritty here pretty soon.
Well, yeah, okay. I guess you're right. Well, okay. So Mikey and Axel end up going to a bar, and he finds, does Mikey show him the bearer bonds right from the beginning in his apartment? Is that what that whole thing starts? Okay, so he's got his backpack or something, bag full of German bearer bonds with a bunch of money, and
I don't think he shows him to Axel. I think Axel is kind of poking around.
Then they go into a bar, and they both drink a lot, and then and by the way, stop me if I'm missing important plot points, because that will happen. But then they come back to Axel's apartment, and they're confronted by two mob guys who very brutally just flat out murder Mikey.
Yeah, they knock Axel unconscious. Before he even sees who they are. And then they execute Mikey after messing with him for a couple minutes and making him think that they're going to let him go. And then just two bullets right to the back of the head. And there's no blood, but it's a really jarring scene. And this is what I was talking about it getting gritty.
Oh, yeah. No, there is that. I mean, it shocked you out of the comedy.
Yeah, my nostalgia for the movie makes me think of like a really goofy, funny comedy with some action in it. But, you know, upon rewatching it, it's a straight up action movie that is funny mostly because Eddie Murphy is the star. Not very many other people in the movie play it for comedy, except maybe Falky.
No, you're right. I mean, the other actors are in a different movie. In fact, I was going to mention Jonathan Banks, who plays Zach, who's one of the guys who shoots Mikey. He's got like the, I don't know what the term is, but, you know, like his eyelids are kind of folded over. He's got that kind of dead eye look.
Oh, he's the main bad guy.
Yeah.
He's the muscle.
Yeah, he is. He's the main muscle. Yeah.
And he's the bad guy in pretty much every movie he's in.
Yeah, I guess I've never seen the show. I apologize. But apparently he was nominated for an Emmy for Breaking Bad.
I've seen the first, I think, season and a half of Breaking Bad. I don't remember him in it.
The sigh of relief you're hearing is that I'm not going to get yelled at for not seeing Breaking Bad by yet another person.
No, if I were going to yell at you, I would yell at you for not having watched The Shield.
It's true. I have the first season, but I haven't watched it much past that.
And so ridiculous.
I'm sorry. I watched The Wire. I love The Wire.
Still looks better.
Yeah, well, again, I had a lot of bad horror movies to get through.
You are the one that made me watch The Shield.
Well, yeah, okay, there's that. But my commitment ran out after I realized that it was going to be hard to find the rest of The Shield in any kind of timely manner.
There's actually a connection. The creator of The Shield.
Okay.
Sean Ryan.
Okay.
He wrote and directed a pilot last year for a Beverly Hills Cop television series.
Yeah, which actually had almost everybody from the movie in it, including Eddie Murphy.
Right. I gathered in a brief kind of passing the torch kind of role. Like, I don't think Eddie Murphy was going to be a regular.
No, yeah, I could see that not being the case, but still. But I guess they didn't pick up that pilot.
No, I don't know what happened. Sean Ryan hasn't had much luck since. I shouldn't say that. He had the Shield. He had the Unit that was on for I think 5 years. He had Chicago Code, Last Resort. I don't know if you saw that.
I think I might have it, but I haven't seen it yet.
Tremendous, tremendous pilot episode of Last Resort.
Huh. Okay. Maybe I don't have it then. Maybe I'm thinking of a movie.
Yeah, it's got that little monologue by Andre Brower at the end of the episode, which is brilliant.
Yeah, well, he's another one who, I'm not sure he's a goddamn national treasure, but he's awesome. I love him. But,
yeah, I'm okay with Last Resort getting canceled because that meant he could be on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, in which he is hilarious.
Excellent. Have you seen, did we inflict upon you the first or the entire series of Homicide?
I don't remember if it was you or mom that gave me that set when I was recovering from my back surgery.
It must have been mom, because I think my version of the set that comes in the little file cabinet is pretty much, I think it's just sitting on the shelf exactly where it has been for quite a while.
Yeah, so mom gave it to me, and I remember actually watching the show when it was on TV a little bit and really liking it. So I didn't watch it when I was in my drug haze because I wanted to actually enjoy it and remember it. So I never got around to it. But I still have it on my list.
It's worth seeing. It's interesting. It's really a, because I don't think I saw it at the time. I think I was working swing shift a lot, and I remember making fun of it because that was the beginning of all the shows that had like subtitles, like not subtitles. What's the, like after the colon, like Homicide, colon, Life on the Streets, you know, Law and Order, Special Victims Unit. And I thought that was kind of unnecessary, but the show is awesome.
Yeah, that was back before DVRs, so. And I think it wasn't very highly rated, so it was bounced around the schedule a lot. It was hard to keep up with when it was on TV.
But the acting is so solid, and you can see where everything after it has to thank it. Because it allowed you to have a police procedural that was more drama than gunfights and stuff. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, anyway.
Who was the creator? Was that David Mamet?
No, not David Mamet, but it was somebody, I forget his name now, but he actually, as I think a journalistic piece, rode along with the Baltimore Police Department for a year. Anyway, I don't know.
Oh, it was David Simon, the Wire guy, right?
Oh, yeah, maybe. Okay. Yeah, that would make sense.
It's David Simon, I'm positive.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah, and here's, again, I think you're right. I mean, I didn't consider this while I was watching it because I was just having so much fun. But you're right. These are two different films going on at the same time.
Yeah, and not in a bad way. I mean, it really worked.
Yeah, no, it was completely enjoyable to watch it. And it definitely is a product of its time, though, as far as, like, fashion. There was just lots of examples of crazy 80s stuff going on. But in a way that makes me smile, so.
But at the same time, Axel, as the main character, sort of had his own fashion.
Oh, yeah.
I remember after this movie came out, everybody had the Mumford shirts.
Yeah, I remember that as well. And he basically got away with wearing a hoodie through the whole thing?
Yes.
And I don't think, did they ever really point out his race at all during the entire movie?
He does.
Oh, in the hotel. But does he do it more than once?
He mentions it when the Beverly Hills PD brings him in after being thrown through the window.
Oh, well, yeah, okay.
But that's about it.
Yeah, it didn't seem like that was a big deal, even though he was basically the only black character in the movie, at least on the Beverly Hills side of it, that I can remember. I mean, well, there was that one detective, but I don't know. He even made fun of that guy for not being black enough.
He did.
But anyway, okay, so plot-wise, so now we have the murder of Mikey, who is Foley's best friend, and he is told he can't do any investigation because he's too close to it, and also because he's in trouble for this other thing. So he goes on vacation, and he's forbidden from working on it, but he goes out to Beverly Hills anyway. And one of their mutual friends, Mikey was working for the warehouse also, or the art dealer as well?
She worked for the dealer and got him a job through the dealer at the warehouse. So they work for the same guy in different places.
Okay, but they were Axel and Mikey and then Jenny all grew up together. And so Jenny and Axel know each other. And Jenny works for this art dealer.
Yeah.
So he flies out to Beverly Hills. There's a little fish out of water element where he checks into the hotel, and then he ends up going to the art gallery to meet Balky. And
yes.
Bronson Pinchot, actually, I think really, first of all, he had a very, very small part, smaller than it was anyway, in the script, but because they liked his character enough, they basically took his partner, who was the guy with the turned-up collar. He was supposed to, like, basically share the jokes in the little scene, but they basically wrote that guy out, and he got to perfect his Balky character.
Now, was that 100% Bronson Pinchot? I mean, was he doing, like a Benicio del Toro Usual Suspects thing, where he showed up, and people were just like, what is he doing?
I don't know. I think he was supposed to be gay. But, yeah, I mean, whatever he did was, they thought it was fantastic and they wanted more.
It was fantastic.
But again, he's in a different movie, too. He's in the funny, lighthearted movie.
Yeah, he and Eddie Murphy actually complimented each other really well. They had great timing together.
Yeah, it's, again, it plays to Eddie Murphy's strengths.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see, what's next in the plot thing? Oh, he ends up going directly to the office of Victor Maitland, who's the main bad guy. He's played by Stephen Burkoff, who he has a long acting career in England mostly, but he's probably most notable for playing Hitler in The War and Remembrance, and you can see where he could pull off Hitler.
Yeah, after watching this movie now, there is no way that you can convince me that Anthony Hopkins did not model his portrayal of Hannibal Lecter after Victor Maitland.
Oh, that's fascinating. I'll have to rewatch with that in mind.
It's the same voice, a lot of the same mannerisms. They're both really campy.
Same hair, I think.
Yeah, if Hannibal Lecter wore bad 80s clothes, he would have been the bad guy in this movie.
Oh, that is funny. That's interesting. So, in what was actually great for the plot and for the continued, they refer to it later, but this is where Eddie Murphy gets unceremoniously dragged out, like bodily taken out by like, what, four or six guys, and then thrown through a window of the building, which makes no sense.
Right, because they're shattering their own expensive window.
Exactly. And making their building less secure in the process, not to mention driving up the price of air conditioning.
And for all of his trouble, Axel is the one that gets arrested.
By the two whitest police officers you've ever seen. But again, comedy. And that's where you get, he gets taken in, and he meets, in the Beverly Hills Police Department, he meets Sergeant John Taggart, who is played by John Ashton, who is, as far as I'm concerned, he is either a poor man's Dennis Franz or Dennis Franz is a poor man's John Ashton. It's hard to tell.
But neither one of them can hold a candle to Dennis Farina.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. And then, of course, John Ashton, who plays Taggart as the grumpy older cop, and his partner is the young, fresh-faced detective, Billy Rosewood, who is played by Judge Reinhold.
Yeah, a strong, strong string of movies for Judd Reinhold before he disappeared off the face of the earth.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and then this, and then what else did he do? Was he Mannequin? He wasn't the Mannequin.
That was Andrew McCarthy. Oh. He was in Gremlins. He was in Ruthless People.
That's awesome. He was just recently... This is a sad story, but just recently he was doing, or set to do, a production of Harvey, the play, and for the first time in like 70-something years or something, maybe it was 20-something years, this theater had to cancel the show for a week because he basically couldn't get the part right and ended up either being fired or quitting, but after like freaking out because he just couldn't get it together acting wise.
So terrible. Like a pitcher who can't throw a strike anymore.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, like he could do all the right things, but he just couldn't make it work. And it was very frustrating to him, too. And then he was replaced by Charles Shaughnessy, who played Max Sheffield in The Nanny. But it's a little sad. Cause,
oh, okay. Yep.
Yeah, because he also has, Judge Reinhold had like a 1-year-old kid at the time. And, you know, so that was all because he's not going to get paid for it. So that's sort of sad.
When you have kids, so he's been sleep deprived for a year. No wonder.
Exactly, and hadn't acted on stage for like 15 years or something. Sorry to bring it down there, but yeah, Judge Reinhold was fun to see, and he did a great job too in this movie. I mean, the Taggart versus Rosewood thing I thought was funny.
Yeah, they play off each other like an old married couple. They're great together.
And then you also meet at this time Lieutenant Andrew Bogomil. I think I'm pronouncing it right. And he can be best known as every white guy in power in every movie since.
I always think of him as the doing kind of guy from Deliverance who did not get raped.
Yeah, he's Drew in Deliverance. But and you're right. You know, that's how you would probably see him more from that movie. But if you look at his career, he has played doctor, lawyer, senator, president, even. He's just a guy who is a commanding white guy presence.
I want to say he was in a 80s live-action Captain America movie.
Oh, dear. Is that where Captain America rode a motorcycle?
Sounds right.
Oh, that's awesome. And was Thor also part of the Captain America at the time?
Oh, maybe. Maybe it was that string of Incredible Hulk television movies.
Oh, yeah. It could have been. That was a weird time.
Very.
Isn't there a whole Fantastic Four movie that they never, ever released? But they did it just so they can keep the rights. Like, they filmed it all, but never put it on TV or released it.
Yes, but you can find it on YouTube now.
Yeah, which I'm sure. Have you seen any of it?
I've seen little snippets of it. It looks terrible.
I can't believe they got away with The Incredible Hulk. Because I remember that as being a great show.
Have you seen it recently?
Oh, no. No, and again, I don't mean being great, like technically great. I just remember as a kid looking forward to that show a lot.
Yeah, no, I loved it. It doesn't really hold up. But it had that awesome, it was either Sesame Street or Electric Company, sort of behind the scenes of Lou Ferrigno showing how he got turned into the Hulk. And they used to play that all the time on PBS.
And Lou Ferrigno was a big deal.
I just looked it up. Ronnie Cox was in a 1990 Captain America where he played a white guy in power. The same year that he was Cohagen in Total Recall.
Oh, wow. He's as solid a character actor as you can get.
Yes.
And I think that... Oh, other than I did not recognize him, nor would I have, except that have you heard any of the podcast or from Rick Overton?
No. He's in the movie.
Oh, he's definitely in the movie. Yeah, he plays like the warehouse manager. But he's like an excellent storyteller as far as like a raconteur. He has stories to tell. And actually, he won an Emmy, I think. Yeah, I think he won an Emmy for writing on the Dennis Miller Show, an individual Emmy, not just a group Emmy. So I would submit that...
Dennis Miller Show.
Yeah, Dennis Miller Live.
Okay, that wasn't his short-lived late-night talk show.
Oh, it was. I'm pretty sure it was. 1996. The award was for individual achievement in writing for a variety area music program.
There's so many people in this movie.
I know. It's a ton of people. It was awesome. And, I'm probably will mispronounce her name because that's what I do. But the actress who plays Jenny, Lisa Eilbacher, she looks so familiar, but she doesn't. It's not like she's done a ton of stuff and almost nothing since, really, of note. I mean, she must have been working someplace doing something, but.
I can't think of anything else I have seen her in.
But yeah, she certainly, I don't know, she was memorable. But she was playing in a different movie than Bronson Pinchot was playing in.
Yes.
She was definitely playing it as if she was still, like, Sly Stallone's love interest. Which is it's a little weird that there was no love interest for Axel Foley in this.
It's weird, but it works.
Oh, yeah, no, it's fine.
Not every movie needs a love interest.
Oh, I agree completely. Yeah, it works just fine. But I just thought, you know, again, maybe a lesser movie, they would have shoehorned that in a little more.
Oh, they absolutely would have.
Yeah. Or worse, like, shoehorned some... Otherwise, backstory unexplored African-American actress.
Right.
So
somehow in Beverly Hills.
So from here, we just basically have a straight-up detective trying to find out how all the pieces work. And there's lots of clever things in comedy in getting there.
Right. So one of the main conflicts for the rest of the movie is that Bogomil fixed his... First, it's Taggart and Rosewood to follow Axel around to make sure that he is not getting into any trouble. So Axel has to do his detecting while also evading being tailed around by Beverly Hills detectives. So there's some funny conflicts there.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the fact that he has, they're staked out or parked actually just across from the hotel that he's staying in. He, from room service, sends them a meal while at the same time picking up some bananas from the banana man. played by Damon Wayans. Not really something you would put on your, I don't know, would you put that on your reel? I guess you'd put the movie on your resume, but it wasn't like it was the, it was a very one-note In Living Color type performance.
If you didn't have anything else to contrast that performance with, it wouldn't have even registered. But when you recognize that that's Damon Wayans, it is so funny.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess I didn't see it quite. I mean, I thought it was, maybe it was just, I just remembered it being sort of cute and then contrast, and then thought immediately of In Living Color, where he was way over the top in the men in film and that kind of stuff. But the banana scene is part of it's like the banana should be in the Smithsonian.
It's an iconic piece of American cinema.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for. And beautiful. You know what? Maybe Dad took us to this movie because I think I remember him talking about it.
About how that would actually work?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure either that happened or we were watching it at home and he explained that that would actually work and how he thought it was clever.
Well, if Dad thought it was clever, that's pretty much the biggest thumbs up you can get.
Yeah. So, well, one of the things that ensue is that Rosewood and Taggart end up going with Foley to the strip club, and that's where...
That's the scene that, as an 8-year-old moviegoer, I might have had some trouble following or appreciating how funny it was.
Because you were distracted or just because it was playing at a higher level?
Playing at a higher level. I mean, Axel has a whole conversation with Rosewood about how it's okay for his dick to be hard because they're at a strip club and he doesn't need to try so hard to hide the fact that his dick is hard.
I mean, to me, the interesting thing about this was that Taggart and Rosewood don't have, they're not savvy cops at all. They don't, for some reason, they just don't have that condition orange or whatever that cops are supposed to have. Because Axel sees these guys come into the club and immediately knows that something bad's going to happen and then has to alert the other guys.
Right. It's mainly an opportunity to show off just what a superior cop Axel Foley is. He's not just comic relief. This is a scene to demonstrate that he's a straight-up legitimate police.
It may be a slightly an element of fish out of water, but from the law enforcement side of it, he's in his element there.
Absolutely, and it's how he starts to turn Taggart and Rosewood to being on his side.
Yeah, and actually, it gives another opportunity for him to be, and then those guys to be dressed down by Bogomil.
Right, and he tries to cover for them, sort of in a way that they would not have covered for another cop. So he's fully, again, gets to demonstrate the sort of idea of brotherhood that he has about fellow cops that is not necessarily shared yet with the detectives in the Beverly Hills Police Department, because it's mentioned many times they do everything by the book.
Which, when you think about, like, I guess it wouldn't be Beverly Hills, but it would instead be LAPD. Historically, that hasn't been the case in LAPD. So maybe it is sort of a commentary on that contrast, because in actual law enforcement, there's a whole thing about ethics and how that blue shield thing, should it works against you eventually. So really, people should be like Rosewood and Taggart. But this is not where this film was going.
Yeah, you have a better perspective on that than I do.
Yeah, and I don't even have a full perspective. I just have been to a couple ethics classes, so... Basically, it's read out your coworkers. That's the rule of ethics. Because if you rat them out early, you'll save them a heap and help them to trouble later. And remind me, I have stories, because there's some really crazy stories of what happens when people cover for other people.
I can imagine.
It turns out it works in real life, too. But not in the same way. I don't have certain skills, and we can talk about that at a different time, too. Not on the podcast, because we don't talk about Fight Club. Or actually, shouldn't call it Fight Club. That would be bad, too. Hey, I answered the phone. I don't have anything to do with anything. Okay, so, see, any other big plot points? I mean, I'm not worried about spoiling it so much as, you know, there's just hijinks that ensue. Let's see, there's a big thing about the coffee grounds. And that's how, I'm trying to add authenticity to the cop story.
Yeah, Victor Maitland turns out to be sort of the epitome of every 80s bad guy. He's a seemingly successful art dealer, but really he's a smuggler and, if not a dealer, at least a transporter of illegal drugs.
And so that can account for why there's this large amount of money going back and forth in the form of the German bearer bonds. And here's where the action takes over, pretty much. Well, should we skip right to the going to the warehouse with Jenny and Rosewood? Or are there plot points before that we need to talk about?
Nothing major. I mean, Axel gets another couple scenes to show how funny and clever he is, so he can get under the skin of Victor Maitland, which just ends up getting him into more trouble with Bogomil, who then gets in, Bogomil himself gets in trouble from the chief of police. So even though it seemed like Bogomil was right on the verge of wanting to help Axel, then he gets yelled at by the chief. And they're all ordered to pretty much ship Foley out of town. And as a last-ditch effort, Foley talks Rosewood, who's been tasked with driving him out of town, to go check out the warehouse with him. And Rosewood eventually capitulates. He wants to do good police work, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, yeah, I guess the last scene before being driven out of town, he basically has to admit that they don't have enough evidence to go and actually charge anybody with anything. They just have a lot of hunches, which may or may not be true, but he can't act on it, especially since now the chief is involved and it's a big political thing. Let's see. Yeah, so Foley and Jenny go into the warehouse where they catch these guys in the act and then get basically confronted by Maitland and his guys, and Maitland and his people kidnap Jenny, and the remaining bad guys are going to, I don't know, kill Foley or something in the warehouse. But before that happens, Rosewood sees Jenny, rather, being taken away and Maitland driving away, and has this inner conflict where he has to figure out whether or not he's going to go into the warehouse against orders. But he does, and he ends up saving Axel by shooting somebody, which is, you know, you can kind of tell that's the first time that's ever happened to him.
It also highlighted that for an action movie, a cops and robbers movie, the movie had a pretty low body count. So I think part of that is due to the character that Eddie Murphy brought to Axel Foley, as being, a cop who relied mostly on his intelligence rather than brute force, to get things done. You know, for, it seemed like 85% of the movie, Axel didn't even have a gun on him. So there weren't very many opportunities for shootouts, he was still able to keep the action going.
But then we get to the final shootout scene where there are a lot of guns fired. Although, you're right, I mean, the body count is...
Everybody has guns in the final scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's not... I was impressed with how many, like, henchmen with automatic weapons were there at the mansion, especially since there was almost no one inside, but...
It seemed like the only reason Maitland needed to have a giant mansion was just to house all his henchmen.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. He needed grounds to have been guarded because there's basically nothing inside there.
Right. Maybe that's another 80s trope with the drug dealer with a giant mansion full of henchmen.
I guess. Or maybe they only got the mansion for like the one day. And they, you know, they're not going to hang up pictures on the wall or, you know, hiring anybody to put like food in the oven. I don't know. Although the movie had, you know, plenty of, you know, it had a big enough budget at the time, so I don't think that was really a factor. Just thinking out loud. So here's where we have bickering till the end. You have the Taggart-Rosewood team through the firefight, which I thought was pretty funny. And, of course, you've got the 80s A-team kind of firefight where everybody's got automatic guns and nobody gets shot, mostly, except the henchmen, of course.
Right, it's very, very A-teamy.
Yeah, because Foley runs across the line of fire several times. And, you know, again, it's perfectly fine. I mean, you know, it is. It's A-team violence, which is just fine. It's cartoony, as it should be.
Yeah, Foley's go-to move is to crouch down on one knee and shoot people. Apparently that makes him invisible.
Of course. So, blah, blah, blah. Gunfight. I mean, should I yada yada the whole end? Because that's pretty much...
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's, you know what you're getting at this point? He's going to win. Nobody really gets hurt from the good guy side of the things. The bad guy gets dealt with. And in a strange...
Comes to save the day.
That's
true. Leads to the cavalry.
Oh, which reminds me, there is something I wanted to tell you about. When we first talked about this, I had mentioned that one thing, and I went on a whole rant, which will probably end up getting excised out of that episode, a whole rant about how Beverly Hills Dispatch, like that's what I thought cop dispatch centers were like. So upon entering a real one, I was like disappointed that we didn't have maps on the walls and automatic vehicle locators and all these things so you can track the vehicles. As it turns out, the memory I have of the scene must have merged with other sort of dispatch center scenes, because I remembered it being, or maybe even further down the Beverly Hills Cop chain, maybe they had a better dispatch center at the other movies, but I just seemed way more high tech than it really was in this movie. And because it was basically a projection on the wall of some zones or whatever maps. But as it turns out, the automatic vehicle locators they used to track Foley and Rosewood, yeah, they made that up for the movie. That didn't exist either.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it's all like, oh, man.
Yeah, I understand what you mean about merging it with other movies, and I'm certain I did that in my memory with the sequel, Beverly Hills Cop 2, which I think was, I haven't seen that one in a long time, but I think that was much more of a comedy, many more goofy aspects. Rosewood got even more cartoonish in that movie. Paul Reiser got a couple more scenes to be funny. I think that's the one where Axel talks his way into living in a mansion that's unoccupied. I think in my memory, I have merged sort of the more campy comedy aspect of the sequel with the plot of the first one. Because I don't remember what really happened in the sequel other than Brigitte Nielsen shoots Bogomil in the beginning. But I remember pretty much the entire plot of this first movie. But it was much less of a comedy than I expected when I rewatched it.
Agreed. It was, but I still found it a joy. There is one problem with the ending scene as far as I was concerned. And that was, well, actually it's a problem with the whole thing. Like Axel, for being a smart guy and being, you know, relying on his wits, but he wasn't like, it's not like he was going to be stealing stuff. However, he had no plan how to pay for this hotel room. I mean, he got himself upgraded to a nice suite at a normal rack rate for a regular room, but he couldn't even figure out how to pay for the rack rate anyway. So the fact that they bailed him out and a police department paid for his accommodations struck me as a little forced.
Sure. It was just a funny little epilogue.
I don't know. I guess it took me out of it slightly. Both when he checked into the hotel and when he checked out, I was like, how is he really going to pull this one off? But it worked out fine. I mean, yeah, it was fine.
Maybe he was going to get out the same way he got in by yelling the N-word until I just gave him what he wanted.
I guess that would have changed the flavor of the movie slightly at the end.
Maybe. He did it in the beginning, and it was still funny.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking, though, in the history of anything, when are they going to let you ditch on a big old hotel bill just by saying the N-word? Especially since you are a black man dressed in a hoodie in the middle of Beverly Hills. I mean, getting into the room was one thing. Getting out of paying the bill is another thing, I'm thinking.
Maybe he'd send the bill to Rolling Stone.
There you
I'm
go.
I'm sure he had a plan.
That would have been fine. So, anything else on Beverly Hills Cop?
No, it was even better than I expected it to be. And I wanted to watch it again and talk about it because I had such fond memories of the movie. But I think it really stands up. It was a joy to see Eddie Murphy at the height of his powers. It was great. I was really happy to watch it again.
Yeah, me too. I got done watching it, and I was like, this was awesome. I mean, just even just the combination of Eddie Murphy and then all the other actors, who most of which you've seen in other things, and then the music behind it, it's great. Just brings you back to a place in time.
Yeah, so I think next week it's your pick, right?
I have to get you a copy of it, but I think I want to do Nightbreed.
Nightbreed. Do you know what year that movie came out?
Not off the top of my head. It must have been 86, 87, 88?
I think it was a little later than that, because I think that was almost age appropriate when we went to see that in the theater together.
Okay, yeah, so it had to have been after that.
But Nightbreed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other thoughts about Beverly Hills Cop? Any fun things to end on?
No, man. I ain't falling for no banana in my tailpipe.
Excellent. Fantastic. Well, until next week.
You've been listening to Not in a Creepy Way. If you have a rant or rave, please send your email to rant@notincreepyway.com.
Like us on Facebook. Give us 5 stars on iTunes. Leave a comment. Turns out you can leave a 5-star rating and the comment could say your show sucks. And it still makes us happy.
Beep, beep, beep. Beep, beep.